Welcome to the Scott Dorsey Show. It's about people, good people doing good things in our community. And now, here's your host, Scott Dorsey.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Scott Dorsey Show. It is always a joy and a blessing to be before you one more time. We thank God for this opportunity to talk to you about great things that are happening in our community and good people who are doing good things. It's always, I believe it's a blessing to be before you, to talk to you and to share with you some of the things that people have done, overcome in their journeys of life that to me are truly motivational and also inspirational. So I'm thankful for this opportunity to come before you every Friday, trying to bring you something positive, because I know if you've watched the news throughout the week, you've seen a lot of negativity. And even if you watch sports, you see negativity in there also. So here for 6 to 7 o'clock is a shining hope, an opportunity to be motivated and inspired to do some great things by great people who are doing good things in our community. As I always do, a few announcements. We thank God for our church in Norristown. Macedonia Ministry is celebrating their Family and Friends Day this coming week on Sunday. It will be a blessing. We have not only our choirs, but our children will be also doing a wonderful presentation. And so we are a church that prides itself on being a 7-day, 24-hour, 365-day-a-week church who's open for the public and who wants to work hard in our community. Our pastor last night, shout out to Pastor Craig and his wife, Evangelist Marion Craig, in the work that they do. He was out leading the charge, as he's always done, in the community, out there protesting and standing up for the homeless in the Norristown community. They were out. There were several people in the community who were standing there and staying there through the night, seeing the experience of what homeless is all about. And I thank you, Pastor, for your voice. Continue to keep on keeping on, because the people in the community need leaders who will go out and fight for their cause. And truly, the homeless issue has been dear to my heart. And hopefully we will have more churches, more pastors who will lead in that fight. And also lead in the fight of fighting for those school districts who are underfunded, whose grades are not where they should be. Again, we need voices. We need parents, especially in the Norristown area, who will stand up, speak up, and not shut up, but continue to go forward and stand for their children. We also have a wonderful event this evening at the Norristown High School that is really set up for to raise money for the health department of the Norristown School District, which will, in this particular fundraiser, will raise funds for again, education for the heart. We had 3 young men in the Norristown area who died of cardiac arrest. And so here is an opportunity to, raise funds to bring in AED machines that will cover throughout the Norristown School District and also provide education, CPR training, to not only staff, but more importantly, even to our children who can also be also do CPR. So we're wishing them a great event this evening at 7 o'clock at the Norristown High School gym. I'm hoping it's packed. I'm sorry I can't be there, but I have a great guest on tonight. So again, I just wanted to give them the promotion, because I think for a great cause, we have to support our community, especially where I go to church in the Norristown community. We want to wish them well and pray that the event, we know the Harlem Wizards do a wonderful job in giving you a great show, great basketball, and if you're a young child, you will have fun. So check them out. It's not too late. Get there at 7 o'clock and you'll have great time at the Norristown High School gym. So be blessed, and we're wishing again that event will be a great event and a great fundraiser. And if you can't go, donate to the cause. Donate to the health department in the Norristown School District so that they can have the AED machines, which can be costly. They're not cheap, but they can also save a life. So please support our young people in our schools, in our communities. Today, this evening, I am excited. We have a wonderful guest who has given us a wonderful book, and we're certainly here to spend this time with him to talk about his great journey, his wonderful story from poverty to where he is today, and how he overcame those things that sometimes we have no control over to get to be in a successful position and do it worldwide. And I may be pushing it, but when you come from Ghana to the Soviet Union to Ukraine to the United States, I think you've been in a lot of places. And I can't say I've been anywhere outside the States. LA is the furthest I've been to the States, and I haven't been outside of that. So I want to, again, introduce a new friend, I'm going to call him, Patrick Assayre. And he is a writer of a great book who I'm going to first just, Patrick, if you could just tell people a little bit from your journey. And we'll get to the motivation of the book. We'll get to the inside chapters of the book. But how did you get here? And that can be a book of its own. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you again, Reverend Dorsey, for having me this this evening. And thank you for those very kind words. So I was born in Ghana, which is a small country in West Africa. And I was born in a small village called Bodua, and it's spelled B-O-A-D-U-A. Mm-hmm. And I was one of 14 children born to two illiterate parents in this village. And I would say 99% of the parents in this village were illiterate, just like my parents. And so a tiny village where there were no jobs, and so most of the people there worked on farms, I mean small farms, subsistence farming. Mm-hmm. And that is what sustained the population. So my father had a small plot of land that he farmed on, and he was using that to feed 14 children in the family, which was never enough. There was never enough food. And so it was a constant struggle for survival, and went hungry most of the time. And crushing poverty in this village. And so in that kind of environment, as you can imagine, education was the last thing on anyone's mind because it was you were just constantly struggling just to survive. You never knew where your next meal was going to come from. So there was a small elementary and middle school in this village, and most children went to this school, and they got basic education. It was basically learning to read and learning to count. That was about it. And so, about age five or six, you went to this primary school, and you got a bit of instruction. And then most children, when they got to about maybe 12, 14, they reverted back to the farm because there wasn't a path out of the village to go out and do anything. So that was when I was born, and when I was growing up as a child, that was sort of the path that I was supposed to follow. But for me, something happened when I was about 9 years old, and completely changed the trajectory of my life. So I was about 9 years old, and I was walking around in this village one morning. Mm-hmm. Our days were filled with chores, starting about 4 a.m. You put buckets on your head, into a river to fetch water because there was no indoor plumbing. There was no electricity. There was nothing in this village. So So you did chores about 4 to 8 a.m., and then you went to school, got a bit of instruction, and came back and worked on a farm. So I was walking around the village one morning, and I came upon this scrap of newspaper, mm-hmm. a small piece of newspaper. So I picked it up, and I read something on it. And this thing I read on it, as a nine-year-old, I read a segment of an article that talked about the most exclusive high school in the country, secondary school in the country, that educated children of the country's elite. And they went from there to Oxford and Cambridge universities in England to come back and then they become presidents, prime ministers of the country. So so as a 90-year-old growing up in this environment, this article that I read on the paper made an impression on me. And I decided I wanted to be one of those people that went onto these into these elite institutions. So that was the beginning of this path. And so, yeah, I'll leave it there. And then one thing leads to another, and I end up in Pennsylvania.
And the amazing part of that is you come from a family of 14.
Yes.
I'm an only child, so I can't imagine what it is to have 14 brothers and sisters. And here you are taking care of this plot, this farm.
Yes.
And basically your day is from going to school.
Yes.
To coming back and taking care of the farm.
Yes.
So you're basically working all day.
Yes.
And you're doing this from what age?
You start about, when you're about 6 years old, you start going to the farm. And so you were doing physical labor just like adults do. And,
right. Yeah, and I can't imagine, you know, we Americans, we talk about how hard we work, but here you are on a farm,
yes,
in a village, and again, poverty is all around you.
Yes.
And you and your brothers and sisters are working daily.
Yes.
And how would you describe the schools at that time in the village? As you said, they only went to a certain era, but we know that early on, if you don't get that early education,
yes,
you can be behind for the rest of your educational journey.
Yes.
So something in there clicked with you, may not have clicked with everybody else, but what in that educational environment helped you get to the next level?
So to describe, when you're about 5, 6 years old.
Kindergarten age.
This was a place where, because of illiteracy among the parent population, birth records were not kept. And so you just walked around, and most kids were past school going age without anybody bothering to enroll them in school. So that in itself frequently happened by accident. Mm-hmm. Mine actually happened in similar fashion. So I was playing around the school ground. I mean, my house, the family house, was very close to the primary school in the village. And so I would go to the playground whenever the kids came out on recess, and I would hang out with them. I mean, starting when I was about 3, 4 years old, I started doing that. So I was with the kids playing one day, and my father's friend, who was walking by from his farm carrying a basket full of produce on his head, I mean, he sees me while playing with the kids, and he says, "Hey, you know, there was a test because most kids didn't have a birth record, so they ask you to raise your right arm." bend it over your head, and try to touch your left ear. And so when you pass that test, when you're able to touch your left ear with your right arm, people thought you were old enough to start kindergarten. So I was administered this test by my father's friend, who was walking by from the farm, and I passed a test, and that's how, you know, I was enrolled in. So I went to, they had a kindergarten, something called a kindergarten. It wasn't really, it was in name only. And we sat under a tree. There was not enough classrooms.
Right.
So we sat under a tree, and The teacher had an easel, a chalkboard that I rested on an easel. Mm-hmm. And we just sat on chairs around beneath the tree and just learned the alphabet and to learn. And there were goats and chickens, as you know, can imagine. I mean, in the village walking around us all the time. So in essence, these goats and chickens were our classmates in kindergarten. So that was sort of the environment. And I went through that process and then went to first grade and, moved along.
Right.
And then it was in middle school when this particular incident happened, when I picked up that scrap of newspaper. And early on, I realized that I just love to look at stuff written on papers. And so that was the beginning of a love of reading for me. Mm-hmm. And that love of reading, I would say, to answer your question in a long-winded way, is the thing that made the difference in my life. I mean, there were 60 of us that started primary, first grade in the village. And by the time we finished middle school, I was the only one left standing. I mean, I was the only one that could... that managed to go on to secondary school out of the village. And the thing was, secondary schools in Ghana at the time were all boarding schools. So you had to leave your village to go live in a different town and in a boarding house. And your parents had to pay tuition for that. And that's really one of the reasons most kids couldn't go beyond middle school, because it was quite expensive. But so that love of reading is what took me progressively from the village onto secondary school, and then everything followed after that.
And it's so important. The art of reading is something that we did with our children. We read to them from the time they were born.
Yes.
And they then, as they grew older and older, they became book readers, and they still are.
Yes.
My love, I was late to books, but the Bible brought me into... studying the books and really becoming a book reader.
Yes.
I have to say that, because from seventh grade up until seventh grade, I wasn't as passionate about reading. But then I started to get into the Bible, and I couldn't pronounce these words. And I'm like, I got to look these things up. What does this mean, and what does that mean? Yeah. And that's what gave me that desire to read, but it is something that I still love to do. I got three or four books now.
Yeah.
I have them in a pile trying to catch up and read, because I think it's something that gives you inspiration and learning.
Yes.
And too many of our children now are playing in their computers, but nobody's reading necessarily.
Yeah. Reading is magic.
It is.
It is magic.
It is. Yes. And I'm glad you brought that point. So here you go. You have this. You pick up this desire to read. How does that give you a breakthrough to get to that next level? Whether it's middle school, high school. How do you get from the village?
Yes. this idea of going to this exclusive secondary school in the country, so that became an all-consuming passion of mine. Mm-hmm. And so when you set a goal that you are so passionate about, I mean, you find you go through brick walls. I mean, trying to attain that goal, and I had. I don't know what I had, a bit of insanity or whatever as a kid. I mean, I can't really tell. But I went through, really broke my back, I mean, trying to attain this goal. And so you were talking about, going to an Ivy League institution almost. I mean, from a village that no one knew anything about education. So you're fumbling around trying to find your way there. And so, studying deep into the night with kerosene lamps, because we had no electricity. Mm-hmm. And so I did that for a couple of years. I actually had to give up my breakfast money to buy newspapers to improve my reading. And because there were no books, no libraries around anywhere. So a lot of sacrifice and hard work. And so I passed the entrance exam to the school. And I get invited for an interview on the campus. And this school was in the capital, Accra. It's still there. Mm-hmm. And so as so my teacher, when I passed the exam, it becomes breaking news in the village because it was unimaginable that any kid would even think about applying to the school. And so he takes me to the campus to the interview, and it was paradise. Mm-hmm. I mean, so again, that makes a huge impression on me. So long story short, I pass the interview, I get my admission papers, and that's when I first learned about the word poverty. Mm. growing up, I was always hungry, but I didn't realize everyone around was as poor as we were. So poverty didn't really register in my mind. But when I went to the campus and saw the children, the elite children who came to the interview, and the clothes they were wearing, and the whole atmosphere on the campus, and I came back and my parents ended up that they couldn't. There was no way they could afford the tuition. I mean, to send me to this school, so I had to give up that opportunity. Mm-hmm. I couldn't go, and so that was a really devastating blow. Mm-hmm. I was almost at the point of giving up on school at that point because if I had done all this work and made all these sacrifices and money was an issue, I couldn't really continue. Then I still had one last year of middle school to go. So I almost scratched that. But then there was this passion in me still to find a way to go forward out of the village. So so I picked my books back up and I study again. I take the examination again, and I actually do better than I did the previous year. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I was age limited for the exclusive school, so I couldn't really even apply to this place. So I applied to another secondary school, and by some stroke of luck, I get a scholarship. I mean, to go to the secondary school. So scholarship is what actually took me out of the village.
Amen. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, God just gets you to the right place, the right time.
Exactly.
And all of a sudden, you don't know how you got there, but you applied at this time, and the opportunity came.
Yes.
And that ain't nothing but God just doing what God does.
Yes.
And so that's amazing. And so you get the opportunity, and from there your life just it changes.
Yes, it does.
It's amazing what education will do.
Yes,
and the opportunities, the doors will open to you. So here you go. You get the scholarship, and then because there's so much to discuss with you in a condensed way, what takes you then to go through the journey you then talk about in this book?
Yes. So I go to the secondary school for 5 years. Back then, the secondary education in Ghana was a total of 7 years. Mm-hmm. And so I do the first 5 years in the secondary school that gave me a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, I find my way back to this exclusive secondary school that started this whole thing. I got the opportunity actually to do my senior secondary school in this school for the last 2 years of my secondary education.
Mm-hmm.
So I get my secondary school certificate, graduation certificate, and mm-hmm. I'm supposed to go on to university. That was my next step. So actually get accepted to the university in Ghana, the Science and Technology University in mm-hmm. Ghana. And so I'm going to be going to school to become an electrical engineer. That's what I was accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And boom, another sort of obstacle hits. It's going to be a challenge to begin with because mm-hmm. Even though university education was free, there was a lot more you had to fund out of pocket. And mm-hmm. so that was going to be a challenge. But then there's a severe drought in Ghana. And food was scarce, and so secondary schools, universities cannot even feed the students. And mm-hmm. so you had to buy food out of pocket, which I could not do. And so I have this admission, and then I come back to the village to work on the farm for another 2 years. Mm-hmm. walking around figuring out what to do next. Mm-hmm. And it was at that point that I chanced upon this scholarship that took young men and women from Ghana, actually from all parts of the third world, Africa, Latin America, as you are. This was mid-1980s, and the Cold War was at its height at the time. And so you had America and the Soviet Union sort of roving around the world, jockeying for influence in various places, and they were all over the map in Africa. And so the Soviets... the Soviet Union was there, and the first president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, who led the struggle for independence from Britain, Ghana gained independence from Britain in 1957. So he was still actually he had been deposed, but during his reign, he had sort of aligned the country to some extent with the Soviet Union. So there was a relationship between Ghana and the Soviet Union. So there was this government-to-government program that took young men and women in their early 20s to the Soviet Union, to other parts of Eastern Europe, that whole Soviet bloc, to study for university. So I had run out of options in my early 20s. I applied for one of these scholarships out of the blue, and fortunate again, luck. We talk about luck in life. So I get a scholarship, and that's how I go to the Soviet Union. So I go there. Went to the Soviet Union in 1995 to study electrical engineering. So that's how I end up there. And I live in the Soviet Union for 6 years. I study Russian, get my engineering degree. And then after that, I found my way to America, and so I came to America in 1992. And my first job in this country was as a teacher. I was hired to teach Russian and math in a school district in Buffalo, New York. So that's
so. How was it for a man of color being in the Soviet Union?
Yes,
and speaking a language. Now, I've been listening to your story.
Yeah.
I don't know when you got to learn Russian when you were on the farm in Ghana.
Oh, yeah.
So how was that learning process of being in a Russian in the Soviet Union? Language barrier.
Yeah.
And you look different than most of the Russians I know.
Exactly.
Tell me that story.
Exactly. So very, very fascinating question, actually. So exactly as you say. As I mentioned, this is the height of the Cold War, 1985, and President Gorbachev had just come into office in early 1985. So he has just begun his perestroika, the reforms. And so I get to Moscow in August of 1985, just about 5 months after President Gorbachev came into office. So the Soviet Union was still a very closed society. No Soviets were allowed to travel, and you got into the country, and everyone on the streets was white. As a person of color, a black man, you really stick out when you go out into the city and the streets. And I went there with zero knowledge of the language. I mean, I hadn't even seen the Russian alphabet, which is completely different from the English alphabet. But what they did was they did a really brilliant job of teaching these young people they brought into the country, to go to university. So what it did was they put you the entire first year, they put you in a language school. So you go to a university and you are studying the language. And so you are introduced to the alphabet to begin with. That's your first week. And then you are in this intensive language program. It's 8 hours a day, 6 days a week. And the beauty of it was, you were fully immersed in the society. No one almost no one in the Soviet Union spoke anything other than Russian at the time because, I mean, these people never had exposure to anyone.
Right.
So as a person who had come in without any knowledge, I mean, you couldn't get around until you picked up the language. So so you had no choice. and so intensive. And within about 3 months, you start picking up the language. And 6 months, you're good enough, I mean, to start actually taking classes in the language. And so that's how we all of us learned the language. And it was a culture shock. I mean, to actually go into the Soviet Union because of the how close the system was, and you were the only foreigner there.
The weather was different. The food was different. The culture was different.
Everything was different.
And quite different from your experience.
Yes,
but you had something within you.
Yes.
That says, I'm going to make this work.
Oh, yeah. I had no choice. Yeah. Because here I was, I mean, from age, six? I mean, right. I have been bumping against walls and going hungry and, not having, any choice at all in life. I mean, you were just hanging on all the time. And so you get... You know, I got this opportunity to go to secondary school, which I had done, and then beyond that, the goal was to go to university and become a professional, and so you get this opportunity to go to the Soviet Union with everything that you have to deal with. I mean, I knew that I had to make it. I had to make it because
you had no choice.
You had no choice. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, we're going to take a commercial break and we're going to come right back and we're going to get into the book, certain parts of it, and really share with our listeners today what you wrote and the inspiration within it that will be helpful to anybody who reads it. All right. We'll be right back.
Wonder if you should get tested for colorectal cancer? Well, it's the second leading cancer killer in the U.S., and screening helps prevent it. So if you're 50 or older, it's time. Even if it doesn't run in your family, most often, colorectal cancer occurs in people with no family history. And it doesn't always cause symptoms, especially early on, so don't wait for symptoms to get tested. Screening helps prevent the disease by finding precancerous polyps so they can be removed. Remove the polyp, prevent the cancer. Screening also helps find colorectal cancer early when treatment works best. You might be thinking, oh no, not that test. But here's the thing, you have options. There's more than one screening test. Talk to your doctor to find the one that's right for you. No more excuses. If you're over 50, get tested, because colorectal cancer screening really does save lives. A message from HHS and CDC's Screen for Life campaign.
Welcome back to the Scott Dorsey Show. We are thankful for everyone who may be listening to us tonight. Remember, you can also get us online and go to the WWDBAM on the internet and just look up Scott Dorsey and you will have all of our shows. And each one of them, I think, each of them are special and they're titled. And so continue to check us out, tell your friends, and we're always looking for sponsors financially who will help promote the show, and we will promote you because we believe in what we're doing is a great cause for our community by exposing the great people who do great things. And Patrick Acera is here this evening talking about his journey, which is awesome. I could keep on talking and have him. We could talk all evening about his amazing journey. But he has a wonderful book that he wrote in 2022.
Yes.
And talk about the book in the prologue. It has motivation.
Yes.
A lot of folk don't have motivation. They like things to just come their way.
Yes.
Motivation. And your book, talk about it.
So, the The motivation for the book, the word motivation is really, yeah, you hit the nail on the head. So the motivation, as I've described, you go through as a child born into poverty and struggle. You go through, you struggle in life, and you get to a certain point. It's like you get to a mountaintop. And you stand there and you look back. You look back on how you got to the top of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea for the book came out of that teaching experience. I mentioned that when I first got to this country in early 1992, I was hired to teach in a public school, inner city school district. And as we know, most of these school districts are majority people of color, mm-hmm. children of color. And so when I got into this school district, I was exposed to, I had just come to America, and I didn't really have a good understanding of everything that people of color have to deal with in this country. I mean, the poverty, the racism, the urban culture that they find themselves in, and all the challenges that they have to deal with. So I was immediately confronted with all of that in my classrooms,
mm-hmm.
and I was quite astounded,
mm.
because I sat under a tree to begin my education. That was the beginning of my education.
With chickens.
Yes, with chickens and goats.
as your
yeah,
classmates.
With chickens and goats as my classmates. and so I get into this classroom in this school district, and the classrooms were, I mean, they to me, I mean, they looked state of the art. I mean,
right.
It was everything in the classroom.
Right.
But then there wasn't much learning going on. So a lot of disciplinary problems. And when I got this job, I was really excited because mm-hmm. teachers had taken me from the village to this worldwide journey, along this worldwide journey that brought me into that into those classrooms. And so as I was also observing the kids, I couldn't figure out, why they were, in my mind, blowing away such tremendous opportunity. Because in the village, I mean, if I had that kind of classroom to sit in, I mean, I would have been quite a privilege. And mm-hmm. so that was the beginning of a whole new journey for me to try to understand. I mean, why the classroom environment was the way it was. And as I started learning more about American society and learning about racism and poverty and, everything that our community, the minority community, has to deal with, it gave me an understanding. It took a while, but it gave me an understanding. And so that revelation, the challenges as these children that I was teaching, the fact that a lot of them are growing up in broken homes and they're coming to school hungry, and their communities have all these problems that sort of impact their lives and their education. That was something that really got me thinking. I found it very really sad to think about. And I left teaching. I did the teaching for 2 years, and then I went back to graduate school to get my graduate degree in engineering. I went to Indiana to do that. But all that time, I kept thinking about the children that I had taught. And so I was just doing a lot of reflections over many years. And at some point, I decided to write this book. And so the motivation for writing this book came out of that teaching experience directly. I looked back on the path I had traveled, mm-hmm. and wanted to lay that alongside the children's the children I found in my classroom. I wanted to sort of lay that along and sort of use that to analyze, I mean, the sort of challenges I faced growing up and what these children were facing and why, you know, they were mm-hmm. having the problems they were having. So this book actually, it didn't start as a straightforward narrative of my life. I wrote it initially in the form of a series of questions, essays and answers. I mean, I was just grappling with a lot of questions. Right. And so that was the format of the book. But the people who read the manuscript in the early beginning, I mean, they saw snippets of my personal story and they mm-hmm. thought, you know, I should do a bit more of that because, I mean, they found that quite interesting. So I ended up doing the book in that format into sort of a traditional memoir. But then I did a lot of the reflections I wanted to do in the final chapter of the book. So again, to answer your question, that was the motivation for this book.
So this is The Boy from Boida?
The Boy from Boidua, yes.
Boidua.
Yes.
And so here you talk about coming from where you've come from.
Yes.
Interesting enough, you see our urban communities up close and personal.
Yes.
If you really want to see them, I taught for 4 years myself. So
yes.
I know what you experience in the city of Philadelphia.
Yes.
And it's different than what my children were going through in the suburbs.
Yes.
And
yes.
So it's a whole different experience. I probably would say to every school district in an urban community, they probably should read your book.
Thank you.
it will show our students what you had to come through.
Yes.
It's different, but
yes.
Certainly a different plight.
Yes.
Being where you had limited tools.
Yes.
Limited educational opportunities.
Yeah.
And you made it.
Yes.
And so you go from what we talked about, motivation, and then one of the chapters talks about the audacity.
Yes.
A word that our former president,
yes.
my hero,
yes.
Barack Obama, used
yes.
in his own book.
Yes.
Audacity.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yes. So the audacity, this chapter, the reason I titled it, I already told a story about how I picked up this scrap of paper mm-hmm. and read something on it. And I wasn't. No child in the environment I was growing up in was supposed to think that way.
Mm-hmm.
To even think that they you know could think about applying to the school and to find their way there to sit in the same classrooms with the elite mm-hmm. children that were educated there, but I had no clue. I was a clueless child. I mean, the best thing that happened to me when I picked up the scrap of paper was I couldn't tell anyone the idea that had come into my mind
mm-hmm.
because it was insane. I just didn't belong in this school, but I didn't know it. I was young and mm-hmm. You know, and I couldn't tell my parents because they were illiterate. I mean, they had no idea about, you know, education. I could have told my teachers, but I didn't because the culture in Ghana is quite different. There is a hierarchy, and so students are not as close to teachers as they are in this country. I mean, there is sort of a hierarchy, and so so communicating with teachers openly and freely wasn't part of the culture. So and so again, I couldn't talk to my teacher because of that. So I carried this idea in my head, and I was walking around, mm-hmm. you know, plotting my way to the school. And so looking back when I was writing the book, and looking back on that idea that entered my mind as probably a 12-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
It was audacious. I mean, for that idea to enter my mind and to actually try to get it, you know, carried out. So that was that I'm saying is the audacity part of it because I just didn't belong in this place. But that innocence that mm-hmm. innocence. I mean, you know, not having this knowledge that I didn't belong in certain places and in you know, that was very helpful. So interestingly, I mean, that's actually a very interesting question, and thank you for bringing that up. When I started writing the book, the title for the longest time, the title I had in mind for the book was Cover Your Ears.
Mm-hmm.
Cover Your Ears. Because when I taught the kids in Buffalo, in this inner city school district, what I found, in the end, what I found was these are children that have been exposed to a lot of negative messages. Messages that are real, but getting exposed to it, you know, ends up doing harm. One of the many things that I've been fortunate about in my life is, you know, the darkness. I was living in the village. I mean, this was obviously the age mm-hmm. Before the internet, and we had no televisions in the village. The only thing I relied on was reading the newspaper. So my only exposure was, so in the village, everyone around you was poor. And so that childhood innocence, I mean, not knowing that
I'm poor.
I was so disadvantaged
exactly.
and I'm poor and the deck is so stacked against
right.
me. That freedom allowed me to just keep going.
Right.
So you were just going. So that innocence is something that I really stress that, mm-hmm. You know, to help children sort of make something out of themselves. Yeah. I mean, as adults, I mean, we have to be careful, I mean, how we talk around them.
To have the audacity to defy the odds that
yes.
people say, well, yeah. you're going to be just like your other family
yeah.
and be in the village.
Yes.
No, I'm not.
Yes.
I'm going to step beyond that.
Yes.
I yeah. love them,
yes.
but I'm going this way.
Yeah, exactly.
And so yeah. that is audacity. Talk yeah. about tragic loss you may have had, or yeah. tragic loss.
Yeah. Yeah, so I write about my father quite a bit in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have a whole chapter on him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you talk about luck in life.
Mm-hmm.
The people you are born to make a big difference. So my parents were both illiterate and very poor, but I was blessed with really wonderful parents.
Amen. Amen. Amen.
Really wonderful parents, something that sadly not every kid is blessed with.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's one of the things I saw as a teacher. And so this was a man who, as I write in the book, you know, did really unimaginable things.
Mm-hmm.
He, this was a village with very low expectations.
Mm-hmm.
No one expected anything of anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, parents had children, they walked around, you know, and they worked on farms and, you know, there were no expectations. And so a lot of parents didn't really do much.
Mm-hmm.
Just laid back. But my father was different.
Mm-hmm.
So he would wake up about 3 a.m. and go to the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he would work on the farm, and my mother would cook breakfast, lunch, and one of my brothers, and sometimes I did, would just, you know, take the food to him in the jungle, and he will eat there, and he will just continue working. So he will work about 12, 14 hours, mm-hmm. and so dawn to dusk. And he did that, and at one point, you know, small plot of land in this tiny village. And so at one point, that wasn't enough. And so he found a bigger plot of land that was more fertile, and he moved from the family to go live in a jungle by himself.
Mm.
and so that is how he sustained the family. And so, you know, you talk about audacity. I learned that from him, right? Mm-hmm. Watching him, how he operated. I mean, he didn't take no for an answer. I mean, life dealt him some really bad cards, but he said, you know, I'm going to take control of my life and my family. So he did. He stood up and made such a big difference in my life. And so, I mean, you know, in all the years I was growing up in the village, I mean, he was always doing backbreaking labor. And so all those years when I went to the Soviet Union, he was in his late 70s, and he was still doing the same hard work on the farm that he had done when I was a child. So one of my biggest goals in the Soviet Union was to graduate, come back to Ghana, find a job as an electrical engineer, a big person. Mm-hmm. And then I would make enough money and, you know, get him to retire from the farm. And, you know, he would spend the last years of his life in comfort. And so I, the last 2 years in the Soviet Union, I traveled a few times back to Ghana, job searching and doing other stuff. So my last visit, which was early part of 1991, I had a conversation with him about, you know, coming back in a couple of months. I mean, I just had a couple of months to graduate. Mm-hmm. So we had this conversation, and I flew back to Moscow and, you know, finalized my thesis and graduated, got my diploma. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't gotten my diploma yet. I made another brief visit to Ghana so I come back to Ghana and I land in Accra. Mm-hmm. And one of my older brothers lived there. So when I came back to Ghana, I usually stayed at his apartment in Accra. So I go from the airport to my brother's house, his apartment. And I go there and I get there about early evening, and the door is locked, which was unusual. Mm-hmm. And so I'm standing in front of the door, knocking the door, and a young girl playing nearby runs up and says, "Are you looking for Mr. Asari?" My older brother. I say, "Yeah." Mm-hmm. And she says, they've traveled. His father died, and they've gone to the funeral." I said, "What?"
Mm-hmm. I mean, and you didn't. So you didn't get a chance to get to your father's funeral.
No. So that was a shock, and. Mm-hmm. It turns out that he had actually died. I mean, that's something I couldn't believe. I mean, I couldn't imagine that. I mean, I had just talked to him a few weeks earlier, and he looked as healthy as. So that was the tragic loss. So right. He died just a few weeks before I was due to graduate.
And so we just have a minute or so. First, I'll pick with you a little bit. You come from Ghana. You go to the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Then you teach in Buffalo.
Yes.
They're the two coldest places in the world to go from Ghana to Buffalo.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
God bless you for that transition. I am never going that cold. So bless you for that.
Yeah.
Tell us where to find the book, and we'll have to get you on sometime and talk a little bit more, but where do we find the book?
So the book, again, is The Boy from Bordua, and Bordua is spelled B-O-A-D-U-A.
Bordua.
Bordua, right. Yes. Yep. Yes. You can find the book on Amazon. You can find it on Walmart.com, BarnesandNoble.com. You can find it in all these places. There are a couple of local independent bookstores that you can find it in. But most people around here, you can find it on Amazon very easily. Mm-hmm. And you can also find a lot of information about the book on my website. It's patrickasariauthor.com.
Sorry. Yes.
Patrickasariauthor.com. Mm-hmm. And so that's you can find the books in those channels.
Well, I appreciate you coming. And hopefully you've enjoyed this interview as much as I have. Thank you.
Yes.
For telling your story. If there is someone who produces movies This is a movie. Yes, this is a movie. And this is a go-to movie. It is inspirational. It has all the trappings of a great story that people, especially young people, need to see. So as we always say in my family, we land the plane. It is time to say goodbye to all of you. We thank you. Check my man out, Patrick Asseri, this wonderful book, this wonderful story. It is an award-winning book, and all you have to do is go on Amazon and you'll find it. So be blessed. Thank you, my friend, for joining us again. We look forward to having you soon. God bless to all the listeners. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, Reverend Dorsey.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
Amen.
Thank you.
Will you win? It's your show now. So what's it gonna be? 'Cause people will tune in. How many train wrecks do we need to see before we lose touch? Oh, and we thought this was low. Well, it's bad getting worse. So where'd all the good people go? I've been changing channels, I don't see them on the TV shows. Where'd all the good people go? We got heaps and heaps of what we saw. They got this and that with a